Welcome to Somewhere in the Middle with Michelle Berard. I'm your host, Michelle Berard, founder and CEO of Michelle A. Berard, LLC. And I'm really happy to share this hour with you where we examine all those places where spirit meets life and the joys and challenges that may bring. You guys know I like to start by thanking Ms. Beverly Black and Tribe Family Channel for helping me create this space for us. Tribe Family Channel is home to an assortment of thought-provoking shows that explore life, spirit, business, and culture, including The Woman at the Well, hosted by Ms. Beverly Black herself. Somewhere in the Middle was born on Tribe Family Channel. And although we have grown onto our own platform, we are ever grateful and loyal to our roots. To paraphrase an African proverb, we are here only because we stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. I want to thank my guest on the March 15th, 2024 show, author William Shermer. You can find William's books on Amazon. If you missed that show, make sure you listen to the replay. You can find our complete show archives, including the March 15th show, at thesomewhereinthemiddlepodcast.com. I also want to shout out Bruce George of the Genius is Common movement, which encourages all of us to embrace our inner genius and share it with the world. It's really essential that we share this message with the young people. And it's not just for kids. We grown-ups need to be reminded sometimes that the world needs our genius. Learn more about the Genius is Common movement at www.geniusiscommon.com. Now, this month's guest has such an interesting background. Born in Athens, Greece, as an Air Force brat, Terry M. Brown graduated from UNC Greensboro with a multitude of degrees, majors in elementary education and psychology, and minors in math and sociology. She just couldn't settle on one thing. While homeschooling her four children, she began her writing career by focusing on small businesses, writing articles, blog posts, and web content. She published 5 nonfiction self-help books dealing with real estate and finance, receiving first runner-up in the Eric Hoffman Book Awards for 301 Simple Things You Can Do to Sell Your Home Now, finalist in the USA Best Books Awards for How to Open and Operate a Financially Successful Redesign, Redecorate, and Real Estate Staging Business, and for 301 Simple Things You Can Do to Sell Your Home Now, and honorable mention in Forward Magazine's Book of the Year Award for Private Mortgage Investing. In 2017, Terry began dabbling in fiction, a lifelong dream. Upon winning the first annual Anita Bloom Ornoff Award for Inspirational Short Story for a piece about her grandfather, she began writing in earnest and recently published Sunflowers Beneath the Snow. Terry is a wife, mother, grandmother, and author who loves word games, reading, bumming on the beach, taking photos, singing in the shower, hunting for bargains, ballroom dancing, playing bridge, and mentoring others, especially youth and women who are having trouble discovering their worth. Terry's debut novel, Sunflowers Beneath the Snow, is a historical fiction set in the Ukraine. So I would like to welcome Terry Brown to Somewhere in the Middle with Michelle Berard. Terry, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I am excited because you're really interesting, and I'm really excited to share your story with my audience. As you know, I start my interview with 2 questions. So if you're ready, I'll go ahead and ask those.
Ask away.
All right. So Terry Brown, who are you and how did you become who you are today?
Oh, so yeah, who am I? That's a question for the ages, isn't it? So I'm a mom, I'm a grandma, I'm a wife, I'm an author, I'm a ballroom dancer newbie, I'm a bridge player, I am a beachcomber, I'm a cyclist. More my husband is, but I follow along. I'm so many things. But how did I get to where I am? It's like a conglomeration of my entire life got me to this point. You know, I sometimes look and wonder, like, if I had made a different choice at any given point, where would I be today? And the answer is somewhere completely different. And would I be happy? I don't know. You know, so many little tiny choices, you know, lead you from one direction to another. And sometimes even things that weren't your choice. Like I grew up, my dad was in the Air Force. And so we did that for a while. Then we were living in Ohio when he got out of the Air Force. And then I came home from school one day in the middle of my ninth grade year, literally in the middle, and my house was for sale. My parents decided to move from Ohio to North Carolina. And like that completely changed my life. And I hated them for it. Hated them for about probably 4 or 5 months. Hated it in North Carolina. And determined to continue hating it because they told us that if we didn't like it after a year, we could go back home. So I had every intention of hating it for a full year so that we could go back to Ohio. And of course, I started making friends and I still live in North Carolina 40 some years later. I mean, here I still am, right? Not in the same town, but you know, I'm still in North Carolina. So you wonder, like, what little things would have changed if I had stayed in Ohio or if I had really hated North Carolina for a whole year instead of adjusting to it? If I had gone to a different high school, if I had made different friends, if I had married a different people, if you know what I'm saying? Everything, mm-hmm. everything kind of gets you to where you are.
Well, I think that's interesting. And you lead off with something that I lead off with. If people ask me, well, you know, who are you? First thing you said was, I'm a mom. And I would imagine, since you said also that you're a grandmom, that your kids are big kids now. They're not little kids.
No. My baby's 24. So okay. They're 20, 24, 27, 30, and 33. And then I've remarried and my husband has three girls. So I call them my bonus children. And I have three bonus children. And they're older than my children. So, and then we have grandchildren, and then I have bonus great grandchildren, two of them. So they run this gamut from, so my husband's 12 years older than I am, and his oldest child is only like 10 years younger than me. So they run from there all the way down to 6 months old.
Wow.
Kids and grandkids and great grandkids. They just run the gamut. So it's very much part of who I am.
Well, and that's what I'm kind of interested in on a certain level, because, you know, once you become a parent, at least for me, that's like key to identity in so many ways. And I always feel like everything else that I've done has been in service to that in some way. How did parenting fit into your life plan?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My mom, I guess it was when she grew up, she just believed that I was going to have children and wasn't going to do what she had done, which was be a stay-at-home mom. And, you know, she expected me to have 2.2 children, which is how many people were having at the time. And I was going to put them in daycare and go off to work in some penthouse, you know, high rise something. Mm-hmm. And instead, I had four children and I stayed at home and I homeschooled. So like completely off the grid of what my mom had expected. And I think it really blew her mind. But I loved it. I loved being part of my kids' lives. I loved homeschooling them. I didn't start out to homeschool for any reason other than we hated the school system we were living in. And my son was very bright. He taught himself to read at the age of 3. By the time it was time for kindergarten, he was already reading at like a fourth grade level. And the school system wasn't good. And we couldn't afford to live somewhere in a better school system and certainly couldn't afford private school. And I thought, who can't homeschool kindergarten?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so I'll do that. Well, then it's time for first grade and I take him in and I want to get him in some of the gifted classes. And I find out that they don't even do gifted classes until the second grade. And I thought, who can't homeschool first grade? Right. By the end of first grade, I was kind of really hooked in the idea of watching him learn. And, you know, I have four children. And so at that point, You know, he's 8 and I had a 5-year-old who's now ready to start kindergarten and a 2-year-old that's, you know, toddling around in the midst of it all. And it's interesting for my son, I started it because he was so advanced. Well, my daughter, who is very intelligent, had a learning disability and did not learn to read until she was 10. And had she been in a regular school system, it would have killed her because she's a very shy, introverted. And the idea that she would have been pulled out every day so that people knew she was the kid that didn't read, it would have just killed her. And instead, she ended up going to college and doing well. And I believe it's because I was able to keep her home. My third child had an eye problem where her eyes didn't track together. And so we did 2 years worth of eye therapy and tracking exercises and patches. And that would have been very difficult had she been in a public school system. And then my youngest child has Asperger's. So that's on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. And once again, not that she couldn't have been in a public school, because of course there are many kids that are, but it really helped that we had her at home because I was able to help her learn all kinds of things that made living as an adult much easier for her now. So I got started for one reason and then I just stayed because I think maybe I was a glutton for punishment. I'm not sure.
Well, you asked the question, well, who can't homeschool kindergarten? I couldn't homeschool kindergarten. At one point, we were living in Guatemala, and I was very unhappy with the school. I am not afraid to say it was the American school in Guatemala City. And I was very unhappy with the way that they taught there, because being from the United States, where parents are very involved in their kids' education, especially, you know, we were in private schools at that point, you know, before we left the country. Mm-hmm. I was like, why are the teachers not talking to me? I don't understand. And, you know, my oldest was feeling a little persecuted because her Spanish wasn't perfect and the kids were teasing her and things like that. I said, you know what? I'm just going to keep her home. And I started homeschooling and I realized I don't know what I'm doing. I have no clue what I'm doing. Fortunately, we found a lovely school through the expat community. And it was started by a mom and dad who decided to stay home and homeschool their kids. And that's, so they ended up eventually with a little school there in Guatemala City. But I couldn't homeschool. How did you figure it all out? How did you, so you had a reason for doing it, but how did you figure out how to do it?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think for my son in kindergarten, the truth was, is he already knew everything they were going to teach him in kindergarten. So I didn't feel any pressure.
Okay.
You know, if I had done nothing that year, he still was going to be fine. The kid was reading. He knew his numbers. He knew his colors. We were involved in some community activities. So I felt like he was definitely getting social interaction. And it was, I mean, honestly, keep him occupied and entertained. And then first grade, it was like, well, I guess I should like find some real curriculum, you know? And so you just start meeting other people though, that were involved. And I tried out different curriculums. I'm not a person, I don't like to follow rules or things. Like, I really don't like having any kind of like real tight boundaries around me. So I was that curriculum person who I took a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of the other. And then I went to the library and I made stuff up on my own. But it worked for my kids anyway. I mean, they all went on to college and, you know, everybody's doing okay. So apparently I didn't completely ruin them. Although my middle daughter does sometimes say that I did ruin her. So we'll just...
Well, I think you should tell her, you know what? Now you have something to talk about on Oprah when she comes
out. I agree. I've also told my kids, I said, you know, if it was really bad, go get therapy. I'll pay.
Well, and then you can always blame them because they chose you. That's what true. My other thing. I say, you chose me. So you only can blame yourself for that choice. I think this is really interesting too, though, because then you started writing. How did you decide to start writing your books?
So, yeah, my story is kind of a complicated one. So I married, I had my 4 children. My husband and I probably should have remained good friends and never gotten married. We were just as incompatible as two people could be. There was never any middle ground. We couldn't find a place where we were both comfortable. So we ended up divorced. And then I remarried, and I don't know what I thought, but I married this man. I think he's a chameleon. When we were dating, he was fine. And when we were married, he was not. And I lived with him for 14 years, but he was emotionally abusive, and it was horrible, absolutely horrible, but I wasn't going to be divorced twice. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I didn't want the big badge on my head that, you know, divorcee two times, you know, mm-hmm. So I stayed with it, and I really, really, really worked at it hard. And during that period of time, I started working from home, writing for small businesses. So I was doing articles and blog posts and website content, small ebooks for pretty much anybody that needed something written down. And I was really good at taking what they had to say and turning it into what they really wanted, because they would give me things and say, so I've written this article and it just needs a little bit of editing. And I would read it and think, little bit. I'm not sure that that's the right word. And so I had a really good knack at being able to take their information and turning it into something that other people would want to read. So that's kind of where my writing started. But I always knew that I wanted to write more. But while in that emotionally abusive relationship, I didn't believe in myself at all. Like, there was no way that I had the ability to do that. He even once told me that just because I could write nonfiction didn't mean I could write fiction. And I believed it completely. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you get that, you just don't believe in yourself anymore. And and at this point, I always say, if there's anyone who's in that kind of relationship, like, first of all, believe in yourself and get out as fast as you can. You don't have to prove anything to anyone. You mm-hmm. know, like, if there's a way out, get out. So in 2017, I did get out of that relationship. I had drawn a line in the sand, and he crossed that line. And it was like, I don't know, it was like, I had been released from prison. I had been waiting, you know, like, like, there's only one thing that he can do that will make me leave. And he did that thing, and I left. And that was the end of that. And I started writing immediately. And the first manuscript I wrote was 50,000 words. I wrote it in 10 days. It was terrible. It was not any good, but it had a beginning and a middle and an end. Mm-hmm. The story has some merit to it. My characters were flat. All the scenes were flat. There wasn't anything gripping about it at all, but I did it. And I realized that I had 50,000 words in me. Well, if I have 50,000, then maybe I have another. And so I wrote my second manuscript. And mm-hmm. that one was better, but still will never see the light of day, because it had all kinds of errors and things in it that just needed a lot of work. It's kind of like, I say, if you were to look at an artist, a painter, they would never show you the very first thing they painted, because they didn't know what they were doing. They were just experimenting with the color and the strokes and the paintbrushes. And that's kind of where I was. And so my characters still had a lot of problems. They were perfect. I couldn't let them have any problems. So they weren't a lot of fun to read, but I learned something with that second one. And then I wrote a third one. And that was getting a little better. And then I wrote part of a fourth one and then got tired of it and left it. And then the fifth one is the one that actually became my debut novel. So, you know, it just took some time for me to develop who I am as a writer.
So now you said some interesting things in there. And this is interesting to me for a variety of reasons. Okay. One is, I believe that it's important to just get her done. Right? Perfect is the enemy of done. You sat down, you hammered it out, the first book in 10 days, got 50,000 words. How did you do that? Did you just get up one day and say, I'm going to start writing? Or did you develop a plan? Or are you a pantser?
I'm a pantser. I am such a pantser. And then I tell people, not only am I a pantser, but I am a binge pantser. So there are some people who write a little bit every day, and they sit down from 6 to 8 or whatever it is. And I do not. I cannot. In fact, if you tell me, Terry, right now, you have to sit down and write, I'll have nothing to say. I'll sit there and the computer and I will stare at each other. Mm-hmm. So I write when I get the feeling to write.
Okay.
And when I get the feeling to write, I might not do anything for several days other than write. Like, there's no dishes being done. There's no laundry being done. My husband's eating wings. I've remarried. So my husband's eating, you know, frozen wings and chips in front of the television because I'm writing. And then when I'm done and my hair's standing on end and I probably don't smell too good, I'm back to me again and I'm going about life and I might not write for a week or two or even three. And then all of a sudden it's, I have something to say. And so, yeah, I'm a binge panster.
That is fabulous. You know what that, it reminds me of, I don't know if you've seen Elizabeth Gilbert talk about creativity.
And no, I haven't.
Oh, she has a wonderful talk about creativity.
I'll look it up.
She talks about this poet. I can't think of the poet's name, but she talked to this poet and this poet said something about the words kind of, the way I took it was the words kind of flow through her and she has to immediately find something to write with or the words will escape and she won't be able to get them back. And talked about this one time where she was running to go get her pen or pencil or whatever to write. And she finally got there and the words were passing through her and she had to pull them back and she wrote everything backwards.
Oh, isn't that crazy?
But it feels almost less like a intellectual process and more of a spiritual one. How do you interpret your writing process?
So something happened to me one time when I was writing that it still blows my mind. You know, I'm writing. I type. That's how I do it. I sit at the computer. My handwriting is so poor when I write quickly that I can't read it afterwards. So, and I'm a very quick typist. So I sit and I'm thinking the words and they're coming out. But while I'm typing, I'm also reading what's popping up on my screen. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing something. I am writing it. Okay. And I'm reading it. And I started to cry because something that was happening was just so amazing. And then I thought, this is stupid. You just fought it and wrote it. And now you're crying like you didn't know it was coming. Do you see what I'm saying? Like so it's like there's two parts. I mean, you know, there are two parts to your brain. And I swear sometimes they do not talk to one another. So the creative piece was doing something. And then the logical piece that's reading it was going, oh my goodness. So it was just, it was crazy. Mm. So yeah, I do think it isn't just a logical process. It isn't just, you know, fingers on a keyboard. You think you put it out. There's something else. You know, I have characters that talk to me and no, I don't need medicine. But they talk to me. Like I get a character and they start developing in my head and I don't usually write right away. I let them kind of percolate in there and start telling me little stories until I get a feel for where we might go. And then I just start writing and I'm very much a panster. Very rarely do I know how the story is going to end. Or if I do know how it's going to end, like I did with Sunflowers, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but I didn't know how I was going to get to that end.
So you had a beginning in that case and you had an end, but you didn't know the middle.
Actually, I only had an end. So for Sunflowers Beneath the Snow, this is a crazy story. I was still living with that abusive spouse. Mm-hmm. My daughters both went to Girl Scout camp as camp counselors several summers in a row. And they always had international students. And one of the students was Ukrainian. She came for the summer of 2013, got to know my girls, came again in 2014, and then couldn't go home because Russia had invaded the Crimea Peninsula, right where her parents lived. Okay, so she ended up staying in the United States, is still in the United States today, has never seen her parents again in person. So, I mean, that's crazy, right? But in 2016, she came to visit one of my daughters for her birthday and was telling me this amazing story, a little sliver of something that happened to her. Mm-hmm. And it was so compelling that I thought, well, first of all, I thought what she's telling me can't be real. Like, I must I must be misunderstanding. She has her Ukrainian accent. Her English, though good, she could be using some words incorrectly. So I'm repeating back what I think I understand. And lo and behold, that is the story. And it made goosebumps stand up on my arms. And I thought, that story has got to be like a movie or a book or something. Mm-hmm. But this is in 2016. I'm still in this bad relationship. I'm certainly not the one to write it. But there, that little seed was planted. In 2018, I wrote 82,000 words of fiction to tell that little sliver of a story. So the last three pages of the last chapter, not the epilogue, but the last chapter, are true. And everything else is a figment of my imagination so that I could get to that ending.
Wow. Wow. So that says a lot about the writing process for you, too, in terms of how you get inspiration. Sometimes it could be something someone tells you. You have your characters that could just kind of come to you and start formulating in your brain. What other things, you know, help you to get started with your books?
I had a song one time. It's a country song, and it was, I think it was called Five More Minutes. And it was like, you know, if they had five more minutes to kiss on the front porch or five more minutes to, and then there was the five more minutes with grandpa or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that just got me to thinking about, like, what if you knew where your end date was,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, what would you do and how, you know, what would that make you live differently? And so my mind started going there. And the next thing you know, I've got this character who is irritated because her children won't go to sleep at night, and she's a single parent, and she's sitting down with a glass of wine, and she says, you know, oh, if I could just close my eyes and never wake up again. And of course, she didn't mean that. She was just exasperated. But death shows up and said, you asked for it. That's it. Off we go. And so she finds a way to beg for more time. And now she has a certain amount of time to prove that she really wants to live.
Oh, wow.
And so that's kind of, this story is still, who knows it, where it'll ever go, because I got to a certain point and it just kind of stalled on me. My dad passed away in the middle of all of it. So I think that every time I go back to it, I go to that bad place and then I can't move forward. I will eventually. I think I'll get to it eventually. But so that one came from a song that I started contemplating. Mm-hmm. Just anything can happen. Sometimes someone will just say the craziest little sentence. I like to write something called micro flash fiction. And micro flash fiction is usually 100 words or less. Mm-hmm. And I actually like the ones that are 50 words or less.
Oh, okay.
And the smallest things will come to me and I'll think, ooh, I could do something with that. And then I just write a little 50 word blurb because, you know, it was an advertisement and it was the heading in my email, or it was a news story and it struck me, or any number of things. I mean, it was April Fool's Day and I came up with an idea and I thought that would be hysterical. And the next thing you know, I've got a flash fiction. So it's kind of just whatever's going on around me. I like to really pay attention to people and what they're doing, what they're saying. I like to watch when people's facial expressions and body language is completely different from what's coming out of their mouth.
Yes.
You know, I love that kind of thing. I take notes all the time. I tell people all the time, you do know that that's going to be in my next book. So,
right. Well, I think that's interesting too, because I think a lot of writers are kind of people watchers.
Yeah. Yeah. Know? Well, I mean, if you're going to write characters that are compelling, you have to make sure that they're doing and feeling things that seem real, plausible. And the only way to do that is to have been observant enough when other people are doing and feeling things. Mm-hmm. You know, like if someone's angry, you don't want to say, you know, my character is angry. I mean, that doesn't make for good reading. And so right. How do we know that you're angry? You know, what have you been doing that lets me know that you're angry? And you don't want to be like over the top, you know, steam coming out his ears and snorting through his nose, because that's just too over the top. That's too cartoony, but you want to do something. Even if you give them a little tick that the person sees over, your reader sees over time, oh, they're angry. They're doing that, whatever they're doing again, you know, they're scratching at their pants again, you know, or their hands in their pocket and they're jingling those keys, you know, whatever they're doing so that, you know, oh, there's that anger. So you have to kind of pay attention. The number of times that I'm trying to explain an emotion and I think, well, what would I do if I were feeling that? And I'll get a mirror and I'll try to feel that emotion and I'll be watching myself. It's like, oh yeah, well, let's see, my eyes crinkled or my one eyebrow went up or, you know, like, what am I doing? Right. My shoulders slumped or, you know, everything got tight or, so I'll sit in front of a mirror and try the emotions, like try to feel them and then look, what am I doing? So that I can then describe that for my character.
That's really interesting because I think sometimes we forget, especially new authors, forget about other ways to convey things about their characters, like a tick. That's a classic one, really. I had taken a creative writing course many, many moons ago, and one of the positive things that came out of one of my critiques, there was a lot of negative stuff, but this is the one positive one that I remember, was my particular character for that short story was, I think she was twisting a Kleenex or something as she talked, you know, and that was a detail that the professor it was a guest professor, honed in on and said, that's a good detail about her, you know, that gives us something about that person. And you don't think about those sometimes when you're a new author and you're so excited about your story. What kinds of things do you feel like were wrong with your first manuscript?
Oh my goodness. Well, first of all, my character had no flaws. None.
Okay. None. She was perfect.
She was like Superwoman. She had lots of things that happened to her, but she came through every one of them with flying colors and no sweat. Kind of like, have you seen those horrible old movies where the women would go running into the ocean and they just run and the ocean waves and their hair and they go in and their hair comes up? You know, when I go running into the water, you know, first of all, my feet are kicking all of the waves. I'm half tripping. I finally fall into the water and I come up with seaweed. You know, that's real.
Yeah.
The whole running in, you know, like Baywatch or whatever that was back in the day, you know, that's not real. People don't, that's not how you enter the ocean. Okay.
Nobody looks that good.
No, never. And so she was like that. She was like a Baywatch character. I mean, there was nothing about her that was relatable because I couldn't let her have any failure. And then the other thing that I did was instead of showing that she was angry, I just point blank said, and now she is angry, and now she is happy, and now she is sad. You know, I couldn't trust my reader to figure it out. It was like the number of times that I would have to go back, if I were to do anything, well, first of all, I'd have to make her have flaws. But even if that were fixed, I would have to go back in and get rid of all of the she felt, she did, she, you know, I told everything and I didn't let my readers experience it because I was too quick to say, just in case you've missed it.
So there's something there about trusting yourself as a writer, but also trusting your readers, right?
Exactly. I think new writers in particular, and I mean, I still really struggle with it. When I go back and do my editing, the number of times I think, oh, I've done it again, you know, get rid of that. Why did I put that in there? We have the feeling that if we don't tell someone exactly what's happening at all times, that maybe they're not going to get it. Well, the truth is that readers do get it. You know, in fact, they want to sometimes struggle a little and wonder what exactly is happening and why. And then when they get it, they get that, oh, now I know what's happening. And they then make a connection with your book or your character or the setting or whatever. So you have to be careful to not feel that you have a low IQ reader who's never going to catch on. I mean, you want to give them a chance to experience the character with you.
Well, and what kinds of things do you think you do better now?
I think that I'm pretty good at dialogue. I have a way of, especially with my historical fiction, there's a lot of information that I feel like in Sunflowers Beneath the Snow, it's about Ukraine, and it starts in the Soviet Union and goes through until a little after the first invasion in 2014. And there's a lot of history that's necessary to know, mm-hmm. but it could get really boring if you just put it in as a, you know, just like as a backstory and you were just reading it. It'd be the type of thing that people would skip.
Right.
And so I've learned how to put that information into dialogue. For instance, I have one of my characters and her husband, they're debating because the presidential election is coming up. And so they're debating and they're throwing back and forth, but everything they're debating is all those facts that would have been boring any other way.
And that people needed to really
understand why it mattered.
Right.
You know, and it does matter. Because if it didn't matter, then this setting, I could have made them be anywhere. But they needed to be in Ukraine, and it needed to be this time period. And therefore, people need to have at least some understanding of why this matters. And so I just had them have this, you know, they weren't arguing, but it was a debate back and forth. And, you know, the wife would bring up one point and say, yeah, but what about this? And he'd say, well, you know, that's a good point, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so back and forth. Yeah, I think my dialogue is probably one of the best things that I do.
Awesome. And you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because when I work with writers, what I often tell them is look at movies or TV for inspiration, because one of my favorite, this is so silly, you're going to learn what kind of geek I am right now, right? So one of my favorite observations of that, with the dialogue giving background information, is actually in an episode of Psych, where I don't know if you ever used to watch it, but Gus and Sean, it's funny little show, we love it, and we still watch it, and we'll do marathons watching it. But there was this one episode where Sean and Gus are on the beach, you know, or on the boardwalk or whatever, I guess, talking, and all they're doing is giving information that people need. And I was like, oh, that's really good as an example of how this happens. You also have things like that in Harry Potter. You know, I love using Harry Potter as an example, where you have complex stories and there's a lot of information you need about Sirius Black and all these different people in order for the movie to move forward and for people to understand what's going on. What do you think is a good example of a tool that a writer can use to learn to write better?
You know, I'm a firm believer. I've taken very few courses. Mm-hmm. I think the two things that you need to do to be a good writer is read a lot and write a lot. You're never going to become a better writer by thinking about it. And you're not even going to become a better writer by taking a course if you then don't go take what you learned in that course and write. Like, you've got to write. The caveat to that is, once you've written to a point where you don't think that you're making any progress, it's probably a good idea to start throwing your work out in front of other people and mm-hmm. asking their opinions, because other people will be honest with you if you ask them to. About, well, what is missing? What do you like? What don't you like? What's slow for you? You know, if you could do anything, if you could learn anything that wasn't in here, what would you want to know that I didn't tell you? You know, those kinds of questions. And that will help you a lot. You know, I found my first editor for Sunflowers Beneath the Snow. It was very interesting because she came back and said, you know, I need to know more about a particular character. And it was like, why? I mean, I felt it was perfectly fine. I didn't need any more at all. And she was adamant that it needed more. And so I went back and I added more. And she was right. Mm-hmm. You know, as I looked at it, it was like, wow, that really, it changed the story. It was so much better now. But in my mind, it was fine the way it was. And so mm-hmm. I think it's really good to have those other eyes. So whether that's by taking a class, and so you have a professor that's doing it, or whether you're in a critique group, or you just get some beta readers or friends, you know, someone who enjoys reading the genre that you're writing, to take a look and tell you, this is good, this is not good, this is what I would do, you know, and then experiment and try some more.
Well, and the thing that I heard you say was you had very specific types of questions. You didn't just say, hey, what do you think? Which is what our inclination is. And people are typically, especially if they're friends or family, gonna say, oh, it's great.
Great. It was beautiful. Yeah.
Oh, you should pursue this. Yeah. As opposed to, what should I have done differently? What would you have done differently? What would you need to know more about? If you could change something about this character, this story, how do you feel like this works for you in terms of the timeline? You're giving them very specific types of questions so that you can actually elicit useful information, right? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I do that. And I also, when I'm reading, I'm asking those same questions as I'm reading. What is this author doing to make this story move forward? Why do I like this story so much? What about this character is so compelling that I stayed up until 3 o'clock in the morning to find out what happened next? What is it? Mm-hmm. So that I can start to add that to my writing. You know, like, what is it about that writer, that ability that grabbed me so completely that, despite the fact that I knew that I had a 6 o'clock appointment, I was up at 3 reading, knowing it was going to ruin my whole day. What is it that they did? Or even if I'm reading a book that I'm not enjoying, why? Mm-hmm. What is it? What about this book is turning me off? You know, usually it's because it starts too slow or the character development isn't very good. I'm into character. It's big in my books that I write, and it's also what I enjoy reading. If the character just isn't well developed, I'm just not going to enjoy the story. I don't care how compelling the story is. If the character's not well developed, it just doesn't send me.
So if you had 3 pieces of advice for a new author, what would they be?
Yeah, so write. Do it now. Don't wait. Don't wait for a class. Don't wait for a certificate. Don't wait for a certain period of time in your life. Don't wait until you've had more experiences. Just start writing. The sooner you start writing, the better you'll become. You know, 2 was get an editor or someone who's willing to help you. But the 3rd piece of advice that I'm going to give almost sounds like I'm contradicting myself, and it's don't listen to everyone. Mm-hmm. Because there's more than one way to write. If there was only one way to write, there'd only be one style of book. And that's not what's true. There's so many different things out there. So definitely listen, try things out, give it a shot. If it doesn't work for you or it doesn't work for your character or the way you want your book to be, it's okay to say that was not bad advice, but it's not good advice for me, and to put it to the side.
Exactly. That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, Terry, how can people connect with you?
Well, they can go to my website. It's www.terrymbrown, and that's Terry with 1 R, TerryMBrown.com. And on there, you'll find all my social media. I am on everything, including TikTok, which blows my mind because I don't even know what I'm doing on it yet, but it's there. It's there. So you have my Instagram and Facebook, and I'm on LinkedIn. Literally, I'm on everything. So you can go there. You can also sign up for my newsletter. And if you sign up for the newsletter, you get the 10 historical fiction novels you've never heard of that will make you cry. So I've curated this list from friends who have read really good historical fiction that haven't made the, you know, New York Times bestseller list. So
awesome. That in and of itself is worth signing up for the newsletter, especially if you like to have a good cry sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And to me, if a book can make you cry, then, and even happy tears, like either way, happy, sad, both. In fact, I had someone say to me that my book made them both laugh and cry. And it was like, that is the best thing you could have said to me. You know, my job is complete.
100%. I agree. Terry Brown, thank you so much for being on Somewhere in the Middle with Michelle Berard.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that's our show this month, guys. You can reach me online at michelleberard.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok as Urban Book Editor. Send me a note. I'd love to hear from you. Feel free to send in some topics you'd like us to cover on the show. Make sure you tune into the show on May 17th when my guest will be author Peter Davidson. You can find us once a month on Fridays at 5 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Mountain, 7 p.m. Central, and 8 p.m. Eastern at thesomewhereinthemiddlepodcast.com. Let's continue the conversation. You guys be good, stay mindful, and remain prayerful. Peace and blessings, y'all.